The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It's great to be here. I'm a Penn alum. I always love an excuse to come back to Philadelphia. Now and then I mention the idea of moving here. My husband is not receptive, so it'll just have to be these visits, which I really enjoy. I'm going to just start right at the beginning of the book and read the first chapter. The book is structured like a record album. It has an A side and a B side, and it consists of a lot of smaller units that are very different from each other and all fit together into one story. So you're not exactly getting a sense of what the whole book is like, but you're plunging in at the beginning. Found objects. It began the usual way in the bathroom of the Lasimo Hotel. Sasha was adjusting her yellow eyeshadow in the mirror when she noticed a bag on the floor beside the sink that must have belonged to the woman whose peeing she could faintly hear through the vault-like door of a toilet stall. Inside the rim of the bag, barely visible, was a wallet made of pale green leather. It was easy for Sasha to recognize, looking back, that the peeing woman's blind trust had provoked her. We live in a city where people will steal the hair off your head if you give them half a chance, but you leave your stuff lying in plain sight and expect it to be waiting for you when you come back? It made her want to teach the woman a lesson. But this wish only camouflaged the deeper feeling Sasha always had. That fat, tender wallet offering itself to her hand, it seemed so dull, so life as usual, to just leave it there rather than seize the moment, accept the challenge, take the leap, fly the coop, throw caution to the wind, live dangerously. I get it, Coz, her therapist said, and take the fucking thing. You mean steal it? He was trying to get Sasha to use that word, which was harder to avoid in the case of a wallet than with a lot of the things she'd lifted over the past year when her condition, as Coz referred to it, had begun to accelerate. 5 sets of keys, 14 pairs of sunglasses, a child's striped scarf, binoculars, a cheese grater, a pocket knife, 28 bars of soap, and 85 pens, ranging from cheap ballpoints she'd used to sign debit card slips to the Aubergine Visconti that cost $260 online, which she'd lifted from her former boss's lawyer during a contracts meeting. Sasha no longer took anything from stores. Their cold, inert goods didn't tempt her, only from people. Okay, she said, steal it. Sasha and Coz had dubbed that feeling she got the personal challenge, as in taking the wallet was a way for Sasha to assert her toughness, her individuality. What they needed to do was switch things around in her head so that the challenge became not taking the wallet, but leaving it. That would be the cure, although Coz never used words like cure. He wore funky sweaters and let her call him Coz, but he was old-school inscrutable, to the point where Sasha couldn't tell if he was gay or straight, if he'd written famous books, or if, as she sometimes suspected, he was one of those escaped cons who impersonate surgeons and wind up leaving their operating tools inside people's skulls. Of course, these questions could have been resolved on Google in less than a minute, but they were useful questions, according to Coz, and so far, Sasha had resisted. The couch where she lay in his office was blue leather and very soft. Coz liked the couch, he'd told her, because it relieved them both of the burden of eye contact. You don't like eye contact? Sasha had asked. It seemed like a weird thing for a therapist to admit. I find it tiring, he'd said. This way we can both look where we want. Where will you look? He smiled. You can see my options. Where do you usually look when people are on the couch? Around the room, Coz said. At the ceiling. Into space. Do you ever sleep? No. Sasha usually looked at the window, which faced the street, and tonight, as she continued her story, was rippled with rain. She'd glimpsed the wallet, tender and overripe as a peach. She'd plucked it from the woman's bag and slipped it into her own small handbag, which she'd zipped shut before the sound of peeing had even stopped. She'd flicked open the bathroom door and floated back through the lobby to the bar. She and the wallet's owner had never seen each other. Pre-wallet, Sasha had been in the grip of a dire evening. Lame date, yet another. Brooding behind dark bangs, sometimes glancing at the flat-screen TV where a Jets game seemed to interest him more than Sasha's admittedly overhandled tales of Benny Salazar, her old boss, who was famous for founding the Sow's Ear record label and who also, Sasha happened to know, sprinkled gold flakes into his coffee as an aphrodisiac, she suspected, and sprayed pesticide in his armpits. Post-wallet, however, the scene tinged with mirthful possibility. Sasha felt the waiters eyeing her as she sidled back to the table, holding her handbag with its secret weight. She sat down and took a sip of her Melon Madness martini and cocked her head at Alex. She smiled her yes-no smile. "Hello," she said. The yes-no smile was amazingly effective. "You're happy," Alex said. "I'm always happy," Sasha said. "Sometimes I just forget." Alex had paid the bill while she was in the bathroom, clear proof that he'd been on the verge of aborting their date. Now he studied her. "You feel like going somewhere else?" They stood. Alex wore black cords and a white button-up shirt. He was a legal secretary. On email, he'd been fanciful, almost goofy, but in person he seemed simultaneously anxious and bored. She could tell that he was in excellent shape, not from going to the gym, but from being young enough that his body was still imprinted with whatever sports he'd played in high school and college. Sasha, who was 35, had passed that point. Still, not even Kaz knew her real age. The closest anyone had come to guessing it was 31, and most put her in her 20s. She worked out daily and avoided the sun. Her online profiles all listed her as 28. As she followed Alex from the bar, she couldn't resist unzipping her purse and touching the fat green wallet just for a second, for the contraction it made her feel around her heart. "You're aware of how the theft makes you feel," Kaz said, "to the point where you remind yourself of it to improve your mood. But do you think about how it makes the other person feel?" Sasha tipped back her head to look at him. She made a point of doing this now and then, just to remind Kaz that she wasn't an idiot. She knew the question had a right answer. She and Kaz were collaborators, writing a story whose end had already been determined. She would get well. She would stop stealing from people and start caring again about the things that once had guided her. Music, the network of friends she'd made when she first came to New York, a set of goals she'd scrawled on a big sheet of newsprint and taped to the walls of her early apartments. Find a band to manage. Understand the news. Study Japanese. Practice the harp. "I don't think about the people," Sasha said. "But it isn't that you lack empathy," Kaz said. "We know that because of the plumber." Sasha sighed. She'd told Kaz the plumber story about a month ago, and he'd found a way to bring it up at almost every session since. The plumber was an old man sent by Sasha's landlord to investigate a leak in the apartment below hers. He'd appeared in Sasha's doorway, tufts of gray on his head, and within a minute, boom, he'd hit the floor and crawled under her bathtub like an animal fumbling its way into a familiar hole. The fingers he'd groped toward the bolts behind the tub were grimed to cigar stubs, and reaching made his sweatshirt hike up, exposing a soft white back. Sasha turned away, stricken by the old man's abasement, anxious to leave for her temp job, except that the plumber was talking to her, asking about the length and frequency of her showers. "I never use it," she told him curtly. "I shower at the gym." He nodded without acknowledging her rudeness, apparently used to it. Sasha's nose began to prickle. She shut her eyes and pushed hard on both temples. Opening her eyes, she saw the plumber's tool belt lying on the floor at her feet. It had a beautiful screwdriver in it, the orange translucent handle gleaming like a lollipop in its worn leather loop, the silvery shaft sculpted, sparkling. Sasha felt herself contract around the object in a single yawn of appetite. She needed to hold the screwdriver just for a minute. She bent her knees and plucked it noiselessly from the belt. Not a bangle jangled. Her bony hands were spastic at most things, but she was good at this, made for it, she often thought, in the first drifty moments after lifting something. And once the screwdriver was in her hand, she felt instant relief from the pain of having an old, soft-backed man snuffling under her tub. And then something more than relief, a blessed indifference, as if the very idea of feeling pain over such a thing were baffling. And what about after he'd gone, Kaz had asked when Sasha told him the story. How did the screwdriver look to you then? There was a pause. Normal, she said. Really? Not special anymore. Like any screwdriver. Sasha had heard Kaz shift behind her and felt something happen in the room. The screwdriver, which she'd placed on the table, recently supplemented by a second table, where she kept the things she'd lifted, and which she'd barely looked at since, seemed to hang in the air of Kaz's office. It floated between them, a symbol. And how did you feel, Kaz asked quietly, about having taken it from the plumber you pitied? How did she feel? How did she feel? There was a right answer, of course. At times, Sasha had to fight the urge to lie, simply as a way of depriving Kaz of it. Bad, she said. Okay, I felt bad. Shit, I'm bankrupting myself to pay for you. Obviously, I get that this isn't a great way to live. More than once, Kaz had tried to connect the plumber to Sasha's father, who had disappeared when she was six. She was careful not to indulge this line of thinking. I don't remember him, she told Kaz. I have nothing to say. She did this for Kaz's protection and her own. They were writing a story of redemption, of fresh beginnings and second chances, but in that direction lay only sorrow. Sasha and Alex crossed the lobby of the Lasimo Hotel in the direction of the street. Sasha hugged her purse to her shoulder, the warm ball of wallet snuggled in her armpit. As they passed the angular, budded branches by the big glass doors to the street, a woman zigzagged into their path. Wait, she said, you haven't seen... I'm desperate. Sasha felt a twang of terror. It was the woman whose wallet she'd taken. She knew this instantly, although the person before her had nothing in common with the blithe, raven-haired wallet owner she'd pictured. This woman had vulnerable brown eyes and flat, pointy shoes that clicked too loudly on the marble floor. There was plenty of gray in her frizzy brown hair. Sasha took Alex's arm, trying to steer him through the doors. She felt his pulse of surprise at her touch, but he stayed put. "Have we seen what?" he said. "Someone stole my wallet. My ID is gone, and I have to catch a plane tomorrow morning. I'm just desperate." She stared beseechingly at both of them. It was the sort of frank need that New Yorkers quickly learn how to hide, and Sasha recoiled. It had never occurred to her that the woman was from out of town. "Have you called the police?" Alex asked. "The concierge said he would call, but I'm also wondering, could it have fallen out somewhere?" She looked helplessly at the marble floor around their feet. Sasha relaxed slightly. This woman was the type who annoyed people without meaning to. Apology shadowed her movements even now as she followed Alex to the concierge desk. Sasha trailed behind. "Is someone helping this person?" she heard Alex ask. The concierge was young and spiky-haired. "We've called the police," he said defensively. Alex turned to the woman. "Where did this happen?" "In the ladies' room, I think." "Who else was there?" "No one." "It was empty?" There might have been someone, but I didn't see her." Alex swung around to Sasha. "You were just in the bathroom," he said. "Did you see anyone?" "No," she managed to say. She had Xanax in her purse, but she couldn't open her purse. Even with it zipped, she feared that the wallet would blurt into view in some way that she couldn't control, unleashing a cascade of horrors, arrest, shame, poverty, death. Alex turned to the concierge. "How come I'm asking these questions instead of you?" he said. "Someone just got robbed in your hotel. Don't you have, like, security?" the words robbed and security managed to pierce the soothing backbeat that pumped through not just the Lassimo, but every hotel like it in New York City. There was a mild ripple of interest from the lobby. "I've called security," the concierge said, adjusting his neck. "I'll call them again." Sasha glanced at Alex. He was angry, and the anger made him recognizable in a way that an hour of aimless chatter, mostly hers, it was true, had not. He was new to New York. He came from someplace smaller. He had a thing or two to prove about how people should treat one another. Two security guys showed up, the same on TV and in life, beefy guys whose scrupulous politeness was somehow linked to their willingness to crack skulls. They dispersed to search the bar. Sasha wished feverishly that she'd left the wallet there, as if this were an impulse she'd barely resisted. "I'll check the bathroom," she told Alex, and forced herself to walk slowly around the elevator bank. The bathroom was empty. Sasha opened her purse, took out the wallet, unearthed her vial of Xanax, and popped one between her teeth. They worked faster if you chewed them. As the caustic taste flooded her mouth, she scanned the room, trying to decide where to ditch the wallet. In the stall? Under the sink? The decision paralyzed her. She had to do this right to emerge unscathed, and if she could, if she did, she had a frenzied sense of making a promise to cause. The bathroom door opened, and the woman walked in. Her frantic eyes met Sasha's in the bathroom mirror, narrow, green, equally frantic. There was a pause, during which Sasha felt that she was being confronted. The woman knew, had known all along. Sasha handed her the wallet. She saw, from the woman's stunned expression, that she was wrong. "I'm sorry," Sasha said quickly. "It's a problem I have." The woman opened the wallet. Her physical relief at having it back coursed through Sasha in a warm rush as if their bodies had fused. "Everything's there, I swear," she said. "I didn't even open it. It's this problem I have, but I'm getting help. I just, please don't tell. I'm hanging on by a thread." The woman glanced up, her soft brown eyes moving over Sasha's face. What did she see? Sasha wished that she could turn and peer in the mirror again, as if something about herself might at last be revealed, some lost thing. But she didn't turn. She held still and let the woman look. It struck her that the woman was close to her own age, her real age. She probably had children at home. "Okay," the woman said, looking down. "It's between us." "Thank you," Sasha said. "Thank you, thank you." Relief and the first gentle waves of Xanax made her feel faint, and she leaned against the wall. She sensed the woman's eagerness to get away. She longed to slide to the floor. There was a rap on the door, a man's voice. "Any luck?" Sasha and Alex left the hotel and stepped into desolate, windy Tribeca. She'd suggested the Lassimo out of habit. It was near Sow's Ear Records, where she'd worked for 12 years as Benny Salazar's assistant. But she hated the neighborhood at night without the World Trade Center, whose blazing freeways of light had always filled her with hope. She was tired of Alex. In a mere 20 minutes, they'd blown past the desired point of meaningful connection through shared experience into the less appealing state of knowing each other too well. Alex wore a knit cap pulled over his forehead. His eyelashes were long and black. "That was weird," he said finally. "Yeah," Sasha said. Then, after a pause, "You mean finding it?" "The whole thing, but yeah." He turned to her. "Was it, like, concealed from view?" "It was lying on the floor, kind of in a corner, kind of behind a planter." The utterance of this lie caused pinpricks of sweat to emerge on Sasha's Xanax-soothed skull. She considered saying, "Actually, there was no planter," but managed not to. "It's almost like she did it on purpose," Alex said, "for attention or something." "She didn't seem like that type." "You can't tell. That's something I'm learning here in NYC. You have no fucking idea what people are really like. They're not even two-faced. They're like multiple personalities." "She wasn't from New York," Sasha said, irked by his obliviousness even as she strove to preserve it. "Remember, she was getting on a plane?" "True," Alex said. He paused and cocked his head, regarding Sasha across the ill-lit sidewalk. But you know what I'm talking about? That thing about people? I do know, she said carefully, but I think you get used to it. I'd rather just go somewhere else. It took Sasha a moment to understand. There is nowhere else, she said. Alex turned to her, startled. Then he grinned. Sasha grinned back. Not the yes-no smile, but related. That's ridiculous, Alex said. They took a cab and climbed the four flights to Sasha's Lower East Side walk-up. She'd lived there 6 years. The place smelled of scented candles, and there was a velvet throw cloth on her sofa bed and lots of pillows and an old color TV with a very good picture and an array of souvenirs from her travels lining the windowsills, a white seashell, a pair of red dice, a small canister of Tiger Balm from China, now dried to the texture of rubber, a tiny bonsai tree that she watered faithfully. Look at this, Alex said. You've got a tub in the kitchen. I've heard of that. I mean, I've read about it, but I wasn't sure there were any left. The shower thing is new, right? This is a bathtub in the kitchen apartment, right? Yep, Sasha said, but I almost never use it. I shower at the gym. The tub was covered with a fitted board where Sasha stacked her plates. Alex ran his hands under the rim of the bath and examined its clawed feet. Sasha lit her candles, took a bottle of grappa from the kitchen cupboard, and filled two small glasses. I love this place, Alex said. It feels like old New York. You know this stuff is around, but how do you find it? Sasha leaned against the tub and took a tiny sip of grappa. It tasted like Xanax. She was trying to remember Alex's age on his profile. 28, she thought, but he seemed younger than that. Maybe a lot younger. She saw her apartment as he must see it, a bit of local color that would fade almost instantly into the tumble of adventures that everyone has on first coming to New York. It jarred Sasha to think of herself as a glint in the hazy memories that Alex would struggle to organize a year or two from now. Where was that place with the bathtub? Who was that girl? He left the tub to explore the rest of the apartment. To one side of the kitchen was Sasha's bedroom. On the other side, facing the street, was her living room den office, which contained two upholstered chairs and the desk she reserved for projects outside of work, publicity for bands she believed in, short reviews for Vibe and Spin, although these had fallen off sharply in recent years. In fact, the whole apartment, which 6 years ago had seemed like a way station to some better place, had ended up solidifying around Sasha, gathering mass and weight until she felt both mired in it and lucky to have it, as if she not only couldn't move on, but didn't want to. Alex leaned over to peer at the tiny collection on her windowsills. He paused at the picture of Rob, Sasha's friend who had drowned in college, but made no comment. He hadn't noticed the tables where she kept the pile of things she'd stolen, the pens, the binoculars, the keys, the child's scarf, which she'd lifted simply by not returning it when it dropped from a little girl's neck as her mother led her by the hand from a Starbucks. Sasha was already seeing Kaz by then, so she recognized the litany of excuses even as they throbbed through her head. Winter is almost over. Children grow so fast. Kids hate scarves. It's too late. They're out the door. I'm embarrassed to return it. I could easily not have seen it fall. In fact, I didn't. I'm just noticing it now. Look, a scarf. A kid's bright yellow scarf with pink stripes. Too bad. Who could it belong to? Well, I'll just pick it up and hold it for a minute. At home, she'd washed the scarf by hand and folded it neatly. It was one of the things she liked best. What's all this? Alex asked. He discovered the tables now and was staring at the pile. It looked like the work of a miniaturist beaver, a heap of objects that was illegible yet clearly not random. To Sasha's eye, it almost shook under its load of embarrassments and close shaves and little triumphs and moments of pure exhilaration. It contained years of her life compressed. The screwdriver was at the outer edge. Sasha moved closer to Alex, drawn to the sight of him taking everything in. And how did you feel Standing with Alex in front of all those things you'd stolen, Kaz asked. Sasha turned her face into the blue couch because her cheeks were heating up and she hated that. She didn't want to explain to Kaz the mix of feelings she'd had standing there with Alex, the pride she took in these objects, a tenderness that was only heightened by the shame of their acquisition. She'd risked everything, and here was the result, the raw, warped core of her life. Watching Alex move his eyes over the pile of objects stirred something in Sasha. She put her arms around him from behind, and he turned, surprised but willing. She kissed him full on the mouth, then undid his zipper and kicked off her boots. Alex tried to lead her toward the other room where they could lie down on the sofa bed, but Sasha dropped to her knees beside the tables, and pulled him down, the Persian carpet prickling her back, streetlight falling through the window onto his hungry, hopeful face, his bare white thighs. Afterward, they lay on the rug for a long time. The candles started to sputter. Sasha saw the prickly shape of the bonsai silhouetted against the window near her head. All her excitement had seeped away, leaving behind a terrible sadness, an emptiness that felt violent, as if she'd been gouged. She tottered to her feet, hoping Alex would leave soon. He still had his shirt on. "You know what I feel like doing?" he said, standing up. "Taking a bath in that tub." "You can," Sasha said dully. "It works. The plumber was just here." She pulled up her jeans and collapsed onto a chair. Alex went to the tub, carefully removed the plates from the wood cover, and lifted it off. Water gushed from the faucet. Its force had always startled Sasha the few times she'd used it. Alex's black pants were crumpled on the floor at Sasha's feet. The square of his wallet had worn away the corduroy from one of the back pockets, as if he often wore these pants, and always with the wallet in that place. Sasha glanced over at him. Steam rose from the tub as he dipped in a hand to test the water. Then he came back to the pile of objects and leaned close, as if looking for something specific. Sasha watched him, hoping for a tremor of the excitement she'd felt before, but it was gone. "Can I put some of these in?" He was holding up a packet of bath salts Sasha had taken from her best friend Lizzie a couple of years ago before they'd stopped speaking. The salts were still in their polka dot wrapping. They'd been deep in the middle of the pile, which had collapsed a little from the extraction. How had Alex even seen them? Sasha hesitated. She and Kaz had talked at length about why she kept the stolen objects separate from the rest of her life, because using them would imply greed or self-interest, because leaving them untouched made it seem as if she might one day give them back, because piling them in a heap kept their power from leaking away. "I guess," she said, "I guess you can." She was aware of having made a move in the story she and Kaz were writing, taken a symbolic step, but toward the happy ending or away from it? She felt Alex's hand on the back of her head, stroking her hair. "You like it hot?" he asked, "or medium?" "Hot," she said, "really, really hot." "Me too." He went back to the tub and fiddled with the knobs and shook in some of the salts, and the room instantly filled with a steamy, plant-like odor that was deeply familiar to Sasha, the smell of Lizzie's bathroom from the days when Sasha used to shower there after she and Lizzie went running together in Central Park. "Where are your towels?" Alex called. She kept them folded in a basket in the bathroom. Alex went to get them, then shut the bathroom door. Sasha heard him starting to pee. She knelt on the floor and slipped his wallet from his pants pocket and opened it, her heart firing with a sudden pressure. It was a plain black wallet, worn to gray along the edges. Rapidly, she flicked through its contents, a debit card, a work ID, a gym card. In a side pocket, a faded picture of two boys and a girl in braces, squinting on a beach. A sports team in yellow uniforms, heads so small you couldn't tell if one of them belonged to Alex. From among these dog-eared photos, a scrap of binder paper dropped into Sasha's lap. It looked very old, the edges torn, The pale blue lines rubbed almost away. Sasha unfolded it and saw written in blunt pencil, "I believe in you." She froze, staring at the words. They seemed to tunnel toward her from their meager scrap, bringing a flush of embarrassment for Alex, who'd kept this disintegrating tribute in his disintegrating wallet, and then shame at herself for having looked at it. She was faintly aware of the sink taps being turned on and the need to move quickly. Hastily, mechanically, she reassembled the wallet, keeping the slip of paper in her hand. "I'm just going to hold this," she was aware of telling herself as she tucked the wallet back into Alex's pocket. "I'll put it back later. He probably doesn't remember it's in there. I'll actually be doing him a favor by getting it out of the way before someone finds it. I'll say, 'Hey, I noticed this on the rug. Is it yours?' And he'll say, 'That? I've never seen it before. It must be yours, Sasha.' And maybe that's true. Maybe someone gave it to me years ago, and I forgot." "And did you put it back?" Kaz asked. "I didn't have a chance. He came out of the bathroom." "And what about later, after the bath, or the next time you saw him?" "After the bath, he put on his pants and left. I haven't talked to him since." There was a pause, during which Sasha was keenly aware of Kaz behind her, waiting. She wanted badly to please him, to say something like, "It was a turning point. Everything feels different now." Or, "I called Lizzie and we made up finally." Or, "I've picked up the harp again." Or just, "I'm changing, I'm changing, I'm changing. I've changed." Redemption, transformation. God, how she wanted those things. Every day, every minute. Didn't everyone? "Please," she told Kaz, "don't ask me how I feel." "All right," he said quietly. They sat in silence, the longest silence that had ever passed between them. Sasha looked at the window pane, rinsed continually with rain, smearing lights in the falling dark. She lay with her body tensed, claiming the couch, her spot in this room, her view of the window and the walls, the faint hum that was always there when she listened, and these minutes of Kaz's time, another, then one more. Thank you. So I am happy to answer any questions you might have, and I think we have some microphones here to help us. So fire away, please. Yes.
I just asked what the impetus for the book was for you, jumping off point. It's so loaded with detail and so on.
Well, I was actually trying to write it. I hadn't even gotten to the point of trying to write it, but I was getting ready to try to write a different book that I've been researching for a long time. It's extremely different. It involves women who worked at the Brooklyn Navy Yard during World War II. And I've got, piles and piles of research, but somehow I was not wanting to really go near those piles. And in the middle of that stalling, I went to a hotel to have dinner with my mother who was visiting, and this is unusual for me. I experienced something very like what Sasha did. I went into the bathroom. There was a bag there. There was a green, I remember it green, maybe it wasn't, a wallet on the top. And I myself have been robbed repeatedly in my life. I mean, it's really ridiculous how many times. I'm clearly way too gullible. So I had a funny moment of thinking, oh my God, someone could take that. How can she leave her wallet that way? And then I found myself, there was just this kind of leap that I made, which I often do, into the position of the person who's opposed to me as opposed to the person who would be me in the scenario. In other words, the person who gets robbed. And I found myself thinking, so who would take that wallet and why? And it just intrigued me. I left the bathroom, I went back to dinner, but I thought, tomorrow I'm just going to start writing from that point. Someone takes a wallet, go. So I did. And out of that came this story, of course, not exactly as I read it, but, the basic moves were there. And then in the course of that, you might have noticed a little kind of throwaway line about Sasha's boss, Benny Salazar, who sprinkles gold in his coffee and sprays pesticides in his armpits. And at the time, I just was trying, you know, I was just kind of going for a thumbnail sketch of a decadent music producer. But I found myself thinking, so who is this guy? Why does he do those things? And so I started the next chapter, which is from his point of view completely. And again, I just thought, boom, Benny, let's go. And so I did that, and I had a lot of fun with that. And one of the things that was fun was that I realized almost immediately that it was going to take place at an earlier point than the piece I just read, when Sasha still works for him. So Sasha, whose inner life we know pretty well here, is now, in the next piece, she's a very peripheral character. She's his assistant. She has a big part in the action, but she's totally opaque. We have no idea what her inner life consists of. But there's one moment where Benny can't find something, and Sasha says, oh, you dropped it, walking down the hall, and hands it to him. So the reader understands why that happened, and Benny doesn't. Anyway, somehow this was exciting to me. I can't even quite explain why. And I felt that I just wanted to keep working in that way, catching a glimpse of someone who seems to be not just peripheral, but even almost cliched. Because, for example, in the Benny chapter, there's a mention of his wife, who is on the number one doubles team at the country club in this Westchester town. Well, that immediately conjures the kind of person who's, you know, not necessarily someone I want to follow around for lots and lots of pages. But I thought, okay, but who is she? So I ran with her, and that piece took place even earlier when he and his wife were still married. So it was a kind of crab walk approach. And that's kind of how the whole thing got written, not in the order that it is in, but working on the principle of lots of characters, a couple of central ones. Sasha comes up numerous times, as does Benny, her former boss. But really seeing if I could write a book that had maximal variety in terms of tone and voice and mood. I mean, it ranges from sad to outright farce. I mean, there are parts that are completely, you know, unrealistically crazy. And I really wanted to try to encompass all of that in one book. So it was kind of a crazy experiment.
Can I have a follow-up
question? Sure.
Just as you describe all that, maybe it's because I lived in New York for 35 years, did you think of New York as a central character in all of this? And that's something that they all had in common?
Well, a lot of chapters actually don't take place in New York. But to some degree, in the sense that the book is very much about time, and I visit different people at different moments over, say, 50 years, having one place appear and reappear kind of added to that sense of time passing. So, yeah, I think there's a sense of New York as a small place that people cross and crisscross in their lives at all different moments, definitely. And in fact, there's a much later chapter that takes place in the future that is all about what happened to Sasha's date, Alex, whom we have not glimpsed in, you know, a couple hundred pages. So I was really interested in, you know, the guy who's just about to leave New York, but he's still there. So I was interested in all of that. Yes.
I believe the first chapter was in the New Yorker.
It was a couple of years ago, yes.
And also, I think Benny goes on a safari later on.
It's actually not Benny, but there is a chapter about a safari.
And that's in the book, too.
Mm-hmm.
They work so well freestanding, especially the safari.
Well, one of the things that I had three ground rules, and if I remember all of them right now, it'll be the first time that I've actually managed to do that after announcing that I had three ground rules. One of them I'll remember easily because it was what you just said. One of them was that each piece had to stand absolutely solidly and beyond that even strongly on its own. It had to kind of be forceful individually because my thought was I wanted the whole to be more than the sum of the parts, but I didn't want them to lean on each other. I just wanted them to enhance each other. The second one was that each piece had to be completely different in terms of mood and world and voice. Technically, each piece had to be totally different from all the others. And the third one, wow, I'm doing it. It's incredible. The third rule was that each piece had to be about a different person. So there could be overlapping people, but there's only one one chapter in which we look through a particular person's set of eyes. So those were my three ground rules. So that's why they seem to stand alone. Nice.
So how long did it take you to get to those three ground rules? It sounds like you started writing from this idea, the wallet, et cetera. When did you sort of crystallize, and how did you crystallize those three ground rules in the process of writing?
That's a good question. Probably when once I had, you know, maybe more than 100 pages and had a sense of that this was somehow going to be one thing. Because initially I thought, oh, well, I'm just writing these individual pieces. But then at a certain point I began feeling kind of excitement about it as one object. I think at that point I thought, okay, so what is it? Well, I definitely thought it's not a novel, which is funny because it seems to be regarded as one, but it doesn't say it on the book. Because it's certainly not a conventional novel. It's not central in the way that most novels are. And it also, the extreme range of tone is, I think, a little questionable for a conventional novel. So I thought, I'm just not going to worry about these labels. But in a way, if you're moving outside of any kind of recognizable genre, I feel it's doubly important to have a pretty clear sense of what you're doing, at least for oneself. So I think that was why I felt it was important to have the ground rules. They were painful to work with, I'll tell you, because there came a point where it felt like sort of like a game of solitaire if you don't cheat, where you're just kind of running out of options. And I felt like I was at the limit of what I could do technically to come up with new ways of visiting these people without any kind of technical overlap with what I had done. So that's when I started getting wild and crazy. I mean, I've got a chapter in PowerPoint. So it's 76 slides. And I actually wanted to, but unfortunately got very little traction with this for reasons that will become immediately evident. But I had an idea of writing a chapter as epic poetry. But, you know, epic poetry is not that easy to write, it turns out. So, especially if one is not a poet. So I decided to spare all of us the misery of having to take a look at that. And I stuck with my PowerPoint. Anyway, so yes, I tried to hold myself to that standard. And part of the reason was that when I deviated from it, I just felt rotten. Like when I spent months working on pieces that didn't make it in, and they just felt like they had a dead root, and the dead root was familiarity. And the familiarity came from the fact that they didn't have that absolute individuality and uniqueness that I knew I had to have in order for this to be solid.
Is that how you usually write, with rules?
Actually, it's a combination of complete lawlessness and total control, but not at the same time. So I write by hand. I write on legal pads. I have illegible handwriting. I can't read some of it later. And I write pretty much in a forward way. Like, I don't spend a lot of time looking back and saying, oh, does that work? What do I think about that? Which is why I write by hand and not on a computer, where it's very hard not to notice if what you're writing is terrible and want to fix it. So that's how I generate my material, really, truly not knowing what will happen and experiencing it almost as if I were reading it. Then, and, you know, I can do this for hundreds of pages, actually. I mean, often it's, you know, of course, a lot of it is unreadable and horrific, but that's what I do. Then when I type, after I type it all up, which is a very tedious process, and read it, then I have to think very hard about what it is, what it seems like it could be, and how to make it that. That's when I get very analytical and ruley, and I make extremely detailed outlines. My longest book, Look at Me, had an outline of 80 pages, the first outline I did, single-spaced in 10-point type. That was just a revision outline for the book, which was hundreds of pages. Then when I go back into the writing mode, which I continue to do by hand on hard copies of my type stuff, printed out by the computer, obviously, then I sort of start going back into the more intuitive state. That's why I need the rules, because otherwise I kind of won't remember what it is that I'm trying to do. And I go on like that for years. So it's a true dialectic for me between the two. I really need both. If I only had one or the other, I would be an anthropologist right now. Yes.
So you didn't map out all the characters and what they were going to do,
because keeping it straight is amazing. I mean, it all works, and I just was curious how you do that.
I didn't map them exactly. I let them unfurl, and then I took a good look at what I had and tried to figure out what I needed. Trying to know what I needed was extremely hard because it was difficult to, I mean, according to what? What standard? So I would say, in a way, I had to, this book relied more on sheer instinct than any other I've written. For example, one of my rules that I ended up having to give up because it didn't work was I thought time will always move backwards. Because as I said, I started with the first one, which takes place, you know, seemed like around the present, which then was like 2006, 2007. And then we go back to Benny when Sasha's still working for him, and then further back. And I thought, this is great. We'll go backward, backward, backward. Not that that's a new idea. It's been done. But I thought that'll be a good organizing principle. But in fact, it didn't work at all. I had two pieces set in the future, and it didn't make sense to start with those. So then I started thinking, well, it goes backward, and then it goes forward. And I tried reading it that way, and what it was just very flat. So I ended up, even that time frame, I ended up having to organize just intuitively, basically saying, having just read this, what is the thing that will most surprise and interest the reader? What feels like it should be there? If the principle is surprise, that was really my principle. So it was a tricky one, but I think I found the right order to make it work. Other questions? Yes.
Okay, I want to ask a question about found objects itself. And I've got to shuffle through notes because that's what I do. But
me too.
There's a line there about Sasha's doing it to assert her toughness, her individuality. And do you think that's true, or is it just part of the therapeutic narrative that she and Kaz are building up?
Well, I think that's how she feels in that moment. She feels like, oh, how can I not do this? It's such a great challenge. Obviously, it's on some larger level that he's trying to get her to see. It's, in fact, weakening her and making her life very tough. So, you know, I think it's one of those stories that she tells herself, and we all do that. I should also say I'm often asked whether I know a lot about, have researched, talked to doctors about kleptomania. No way. I made this up. I have no medical degree. I presume no expertise. I just kind of wrote it as it seemed right, extrapolating really just from, you know, what I know of compulsion, and who doesn't know something about that. You know, I made it up. I really did. Yes.
You mentioned the presence of the PowerPoint in this work, and there's the whole thing with the cell phones in the keep or their absence. Can we get your take on the ebook and what it means to serious fiction?
You know, I mean, it's real. I'm really talking out of my hat. I don't really see the ebook as a threat in any way except financially. I mean, theoretically, there is, if people are reading these books, there's no, I don't have a problem with their doing it in an electronic way. I don't think it's like the music industry where the fact of ebooks is actually going to decimate the industry and change the way people read. And for the music industry, it's been a nightmare. I mean, starting with theft, moving into economics, and finally now arriving at a point where people don't buy music. They buy it in this very atomized way, which makes it impossible for a musician to create the equivalent of this book, because all they'll sell is a couple of chapters, the equivalent of a couple of chapters. So that's been really tough, and that's a huge part of this book is actually, you know, Benny's feelings in particular about the movement of the music world into the digital. I don't see those kind of exactly those problems arising for serious fiction. Although, you know, when people are reading something on an iPad and checking their email at the same time, is that really a rich reading experience? I mean, those, of course, being of the generation that I am, having not grown up with a computer, I can't help but think my way was better. But you know what? What person in their 40s doesn't say that? And we all knew when we were kids how terribly boring it was to hear it. So I try to keep my mouth shut about that. there is a business model problem for the publishing industry and for writers around ebooks, which is that the purveyors of ebooks charge much less for them than they charge for hardbacks. And the argument there is that this is okay because you don't have to pay for paper and binding. It doesn't really make sense. That's not the bulk of what it costs to make a book. It's the writer's time. It's the publisher's effort. It's the, you know, getting the book out there, marketing it, all of that stuff. So far, none of this has really come home to roost because companies like Amazon are using ebooks as a loss leader, and they just take the hit. They charge less, and they absorb the difference. But everyone is waiting, slightly scared, for the moment when Amazon and or others say, you know, we're actually not going to do that anymore. We're going to pay you less for these ebooks, and what are you going to do about it? That's what everyone's really scared about. Hasn't happened yet, and the fact that there are suddenly a lot of other reading devices cropping up that are competing with Kindle, everyone seems to feel is pretty good because Amazon now has other worries and competition to think about, so we'll see whether the market economy really does its job there. But it's just a moment of huge unknowns. And in fact, apparently, what I hear is there is actually a lot of piracy out there, too. There are websites you can go to and download free books. I mean, Google has screened everything. So there are visuals of every book, pretty much. It's only a matter of time before people start to figure out how to get those. And if you can get pirated versions onto your ebook reader and you're the kind of person who's comfortable going for it or thinks everything on the web should be free, why would you not just read those versions? Well, then we can't make a living. So all of that is scary, but you know, this is a moment where in every industry or many, there's the equivalent of this kind of worry. And we're just at a moment of, a great uncertainty, but you know, on good days, I think like enormous possibility, well, or at least it's kind of fascinating to be in a moment of such transition. I do enjoy that as an observer when I'm not worrying that my children will never read. Yes.
Just a quick footnote question. Did you have any trouble with your publishers or agent or anything with this thing that didn't belong as a novel, it really wasn't a novel, et cetera? Did you have any trouble kind of convincing them that this really was?
I really didn't, which I think speaks very well of them. I worried that I would because The Keep, my last book, is much more kind of high concept and thrillery, and it did well. And I was worried that the reaction in these tough times would be, oh, my God, you know, in the middle of a recession, you give us this? What are you thinking? But they didn't react that way. They took it basically at face value and said, we find it compelling. And so they went for it. And then I really wondered what they would think when I produced the PowerPoint, which they weren't expecting because I had already sold the book. That was kind of an add-on. And it was, you know, I held my breath when I pressed send. I have a new piece. They were happy to hear that. But then when it came with viewing instructions and how to present it as a slideshow, I think they were taken aback. And I had said, don't print this. Look at it on a screen. That's really how PowerPoint is meant to be viewed. But, you know, the publishing world is so print-oriented. Everyone dutifully printed it out and looked at it, you know, on these sort of crummy Xeroxy copies. So I probably would have done the same thing. But again, they were game. I mean, it's cool because you're reading the book this way, and then you get to the PowerPoint, and you have to turn it like that. And they even turned the page numbers on their side. So they went for it. I should also mention that the PowerPoint, I created a color version, which was a lot of fun. It was kind of agonizing to do a PowerPoint. I mean, not that I've had so much experience with PowerPoint, but color is one aspect of it that is, you know, meaningful, and I couldn't use that. But I created a color version, which is on my website, jenniferegan.com, and it also has a soundtrack of sorts because the PowerPoint chapter, which is called Great Rock and Roll Pauses, is actually the journal, what you're reading in slides, is the journal of the daughter of Sasha, the woman I was just reading to you about. So it's many years later. They live in the California desert, and this girl is telling the story of her family life, basically, over a couple of days. And one of the sources of tension is that her older brother has a sort of Asperger's obsession with the pauses in rock and roll songs. And he plays them obsessively. In fact, he loops just the pauses and makes everyone listen to those. So his father is going out of his mind. He can't take it. And so, in my color version, I include 10-second snippets of the music, the parts of the songs that this brother talks about that have the pauses in them. So that's fun. Like, you can't really do that in a conventional novel. So I have to say I enjoyed it a lot. Both of you, in some order.
Is it fair to ask what happens to golf courses in the future?
The golf courses exist in a sort of ghostly, dried-out form in the California desert of the future where the PowerPoint takes place. They go to a ruined golf course at one point, and it looks like the moon. It's only a matter of time, right? Come on. Those huge golf courses, please. This woman also had a question in the green, turquoise shirt.
Where do you come up with the pauses in rock and roll? I mean...
Well, I actually do know where I came up with that. I was researching the music industry, about which I actually knew very little. And I read a book called So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star, which is actually very good. It's by the drummer for the band Semisonic, best known for their extreme hit Closing Time of some years ago. Everyone in this room would recognize it, I promise. Anyway, this book was great. I mean, it told the story of the band becoming huge and then completely falling apart. Like, they had one huge hit and then their next album didn't do well. And this guy just has a writer's sensibility. And one of the funny stories he told was about the mixing of Closing Time, their big hit. And there was this guy who was doing the mixing, and I'm forgetting his name. I can't remember, but he's known for inserting small pauses, dramatic pauses into songs, and he did that with Closing Time. And it's curious to me that that really stuck in my mind, the idea that there was this guy who specialized in pauses. That seemed really evocative somehow. So I found myself thinking about it. In one of the failed stories that I didn't include, there was an academic who was writing a book about the pauses in rock and roll songs. So I kept sort of trying to approach this, but I couldn't find a way. And then once I actually was creating the PowerPoint, I understood more why the pauses had been obsessing me. I mean, the book is so much about time, and the real influence is Proust, whose book I was reading over many years, the last many years. And in a way, the perception of time is all about pauses. You know, time passes so incrementally, and yet there are these moments where you think, oh, my God, time has passed. Where did it go? So there's this herky-jerky, almost staccato quality of time passing, which I think, in a way, is something I was exploring in PowerPoint, which exists in these series of moments as opposed to the continuity of, say, a conventional story. So all of that was what interested me. But at the time, I didn't even know it, but I just kind of went for it. Yes?
I actually have two questions. One is, how did you get your start in writing? And also, who do you like to read?
You know, I didn't really get my start at any particular moment. I knew I wanted to be a writer basically from the age of 18. I moved to New York. I went to Penn, and I had a scholarship to study in England for 2 years, so I did that. And then I moved to New York, and I had written this god-awful book while I was in England, which I thought was a masterpiece, partly because no one had read it. So I was blissfully alone in my experience of it. Almost the minute I began showing it to people, I made the unfortunate discovery that others did not share my opinion. So that was a very tough period, and looking back, I'm not quite sure why I stuck with it. I mean, it was kind of nonsensical. Like, my writing was terrible. My parents wanted me to get a job. It was just rough. But I just kind of doggedly worked away. I feel like my story is one of kind of little incremental shifts and developments, but not sort of the big lightning bolt. I sold my first story to The New Yorker when I was pretty young. I was 26. And you would think that was a lightning bolt to the extent that it definitely got my parents' attention. But I didn't really have much to follow that up with. That was the best thing I had done. And people said, oh, wow, let's see what else you've got. And I showed it to them, and they thought, oh, that's the best thing she's done, and it's already been published. So in a way, it was a great break, but it led to, you know, not much in the immediate future. So I just slowly and surely have kept, you know, trying to push myself to do things that seemed interesting and keep publishing. It's kind of how it's worked. One more? Oh, who do I read? Oh, I mean, tons of different people. There are writers that I love. I mean, I adore Edith Wharton, Virginia Woolf, Zola. I mean, they're, you know, back to the beginning, Cervantes, Lawrence Stern. But there are also particular books that I think really have influenced my different books. And for this book, for sure, Proust is number one. I think everyone should, there should be a warning sign on the cover of, or the covers of In Search of Lost Time saying, don't bother until you're 40. Because it's, you know, what do we care about time passing when you're 21? So that was huge. But then interestingly, the other text, if you will, that I think probably had the most influence on this book was the TV show The Sopranos, which I adored and was kind of, I was really fascinated by its power. And I spent time thinking about what made it so gripping, what made me think about it so much as if it were a novel I were reading. And I think the two things that it left me with, or two of the keys to its power, I think, are one, the way it plays with the difference between public and private. And I kind of alluded to some of this earlier. There are characters, and the characters seem almost cliched, and yet when we're plunged into their inner lives, their private lives, they seem incredibly nuanced. So there's this huge chasm between the way people appear and the way they really are. And of course, that chasm exists in life, as we all know. And then the other thing I really loved was the way that characters went from being peripheral to central and then back to peripheral at different moments. And I played very much with that in here, too. So Proust and Sopranos, you wouldn't think that they might combine, but somehow their DNA smashed together, and this is what we got from it. Is one more, or are we done? Okay. I think we're done. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.